My name is Brenda, and I'm a member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon. And I will be chairing tonight's speaker meeting, our Al-Anon speaker meeting. To anyone just joining us, we wish to welcome you to the Fellowship of the Spirit New York. We will open this meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The anonymity statement. There may be some of you here who are not familiar with the traditions of our personal anonymity at the public level. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and film. Thus, we respectfully ask that speakers, AA and Al-Anon, speakers and members not be photographed, videotaped, or identified by their full name on audio tape or in any published or broadcast reports of our meetings, included those reports on the internet or other new media technologies. The assurance of anonymity is essential in our efforts to help other problem drinkers who wish to share our recovery program with us. And our tradition of anonymity reminds us of the AA and Al-Anon principles come before personalities. Please note that the conference is being recorded and try to be mindful when you have the opportunity to share. Thank you. The Al-Anon preamble. The Al-Anon family groups are a fellowship of relatives and friends of alcoholics who share their experience, strength, and hope in order to solve their common problems. We believe alcoholism is a family illness and that changed attitudes can aid recovery. Al-Anon is not allied with any sect, denomination, political entity, organization, or institution. Does not engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any cause. There are no dues for membership. Al-Anon is self-supporting through its own voluntary contributions. Al-Anon has but one purpose, to help families of alcoholics. We do this by practicing the 12 steps of AA ourselves, by welcoming and giving comfort to families of alcoholics, and by giving understanding and encouragement to the alcoholic. The disclaimer. In keeping with the spirit of this conference, the members of Al-Anon Planning Committee would like to acknowledge that the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is not Al-Anon conference group literature, and that the Big Book is not used at regularly scheduled Al-Anon meetings. However, in this meeting, the primary focus of the meeting is on the Big Book. This Al-Anon meeting recognizes the benefits of its use and encourages participants of the meetings to share, if they wish, on how they would benefit from the use of the Big Book in their personal recovery. Tonight, I have asked Marilyn B. from Westminster, Colorado, to share her reading of the 12 steps. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Marilyn, and I'm a grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Al-Ateen. Study of these steps is essential to the progress in the Al-Anon program. The principles they embody are universal, applicable to everyone, whatever his personal creed. In Al-Anon, we strive for an ever deeper understanding of these steps and pray for the wisdom to apply them to our lives. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Marilyn. And now we will have Marion M. from Denver, Colorado, read the 12 traditions.
Thank you. My name is Marion from Denver. Our 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal progress for the greatest number depends upon unity. Two, for our group purposes, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the relatives of alcoholics, when gathered together for mutual aid, may call themselves an Al-Anon family group, provided that as a group, they have no other affiliation. The only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism in a relative or a friend. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting another group or Al-Anon or AA as a whole. Five, each Al-Anon family group has but one purpose, to help families of alcoholics. We do this by practicing the 12 steps of AA ourselves, by encouraging and understanding our alcoholic relatives, and by welcoming and giving comfort to the families of alcoholics. Six, our family groups ought never endorse, finance, or lend our names to any outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary spiritual aim. Although a separate entity, we must always cooperate with Alcoholics Anonymous. Seven, every group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Al-Anon 12-step work should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, our groups as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, the Al-Anon family groups have no opinion on outside issues, hence our name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, films, and TV. We need guard with special care the anonymity of all AA members. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles above personalities.
Thank you, Marion. Thank you, Devin, for asking me to introduce Gary. So it's really kind of funny because when he asked me, he basically said, you'll introduce Kiri as I wish. And I have to share a quick bit. Last year, I got to help her husband and her children celebrate a milestone birthday for her. And it was a themed party. And on her cake, it says, as you wish. So I get to share a bit and introduce Kiri, our speaker for tonight. I met Kiri through my sponsor in California. I had relocated from California to Colorado and struggling a bit to try and find my group here. So my sponsor realized through Facebook that she knew somebody else who had moved to the area. She knew Kiri through Alateen, and she said, I'm going to give you her number. You need to call her. And I did so because I take sponsor direction, and I called her, and then I got off the phone with Kiri. And then I immediately called my sponsor back saying, yes, absolutely, I needed to call her. Because on that phone conversation, Kiri said, there's a great meeting that you need to go to on Wednesday night. There's another meeting that has babysitting. We're going to do a big book study on Wednesday night. Check this one out. And immediately, we kind of became fast friends. And so we have, through over the last 12 years that I've lived here in Colorado, we have done fellowship together. We have traveled together. We do lots of things together. And I am just privileged and honored to share this night with her and to introduce Kiri Collins, Kiri C, from Castle Rock, Colorado. Here we go. Thanks, Kiri.
Thanks so much, Brenda. Gosh, I'm already getting very emotional. I am so humbled and so honored to be here with all of you guys and surrounded by my Fox family. And I'm getting emotional because I'm seeing faces that I haven't seen in several weeks, and it's very, very nice. And I'm going to try to keep it together from here forward. We're just going to reset here forward. I'm going to keep it together. I'm not going to cry, right? All of my friends, people who know me completely believe that. Devin, I want to thank you for inviting me to be a part of this conference. It's really, truly an amazing experience. And it gave me the incentive to start organizing my office. Doesn't it look pretty? Because I knew that there were going to be hundreds of people in my office with me tonight. But it happened really fast. So I can't pan the camera. Over here is my powerlessness and my unmanageability on this side of the office. We're not quite there yet. I have a friend of mine who I've known a long time in Al-Anon who always says, hang out in the middle and you won't fall off the edge. And I feel like this weekend has been the middle for me. You know, I think that this, it's funny. I think that a lot of us are perfectly content and happy with staying home until we're told we have to. And then suddenly we're like, I don't know if that's such a good idea. But here's where we are. And the timing of this is perfect. On Friday, I found out, I got notification from our school districts that our children will not be returning to school for the remainder of the school year. So we will continue the at-home learning. And my younger son said to me yesterday, hey, Mom, do you realize that we've only been in quarantine for 3 weeks and we still have another 4 to 7 to go? I thought, that is not helpful information. So I'm really grateful to have this opportunity to be here with all of you guys. And I thank all of the speakers and the panels. You know, when Devin sent me the spreadsheet of who was participating, it was just a bunch of, I wouldn't even say familiar names, I would say friends and family. And it really does feel like a family reunion. And I've been grateful for all of the serenity that that I've felt in my heart in the midst of the chaos. Years ago, when I was an Alateen sponsor, there was a kid who had, he was an artist and he drew this picture in his sketchbook with pencil and charcoal. I don't remember really well, but there was like a silhouette of a person and all of this storm going all around, just chaos, like a tornado all around. It was dark and kind of scary looking. And a fellow Alateen sponsor, whose name was Bruce, he's passed on now, but he had written on there, sometimes my higher power calms the storm. And sometimes my higher power lets the storm rage and calms me, his child. And I was reminded this weekend, and I'm so happy for this reminder because sometimes I forget this, is that my relationship with my higher power is not dependent on my external circumstances. And it doesn't matter what's happening in this world right now, or in my own home or with my job. My relationship with my higher power really depends on my willingness to be a part of it and be an active participant in that. So with that, I will try to tell you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. I come from an alcoholic family. My father was a sober member of AA for many years before he passed away. But he wasn't sober when my parents met, and they were 17 and 18 when they found out that they were pregnant with me and they got married. Because that's what you did back then. And the marriage did not last for very long. It only lasted a few years before it sort of fell apart. My dad left and immediately married another woman who had a child about 8 months younger than me. And that was the beginning for me of feeling like second best. You know, that's what I saw in my little child mind, is that he left me and my mom to go be with this other woman and her little girl. And this is a feeling that continues to persist for me today. I always feel like an outsider at some level, not always, but it crops up over and over and over again. Recently, I heard in a meeting, well, obviously not that recently, that recovery is like a spiral and that it continues to go out like this. And because of that, what happens is we continue to face the same situations over and over again. And sometimes I feel like, gosh, I've been in Al-Anon long enough that I shouldn't be feeling this way anymore. I shouldn't have these thoughts anymore in my head. But, you know, it's part of that spiral. And I come across it again. I feel like an outsider. When I was a little girl, my mom was the only single mom that I knew. We lived in a small town in Texas, and it seemed like everybody was a two-parent family with lots of brothers and sisters, and it was just me and my mom, and I felt different. And when my mom remarried, when I was 12 years old, and she and my stepfather started having more babies, and I felt like they had a family and I wasn't really a part of that, and I felt like an outsider and I felt different. And it can still crop up today in pretty much any situation. And within the rooms of Al-Anon and AA are the only place that I always feel accepted and welcome. I've been getting texts all weekend from people who saw my name on the schedule and have been just sending me love, and gosh, I'm just so appreciative of all of the love that's been coming through me. So, you know, I was really loved as a child. My mom was the one of seven children. She was the first one to get divorced. And so all of my aunts and my uncles and my grandparents really rallied around me and tried to give extra presents at Christmas time. And I never felt unloved at all as a child, but being loved isn't going to protect anybody from the effects of alcoholism. I want to read you real quick one of my favorite passages. I say every time I read anything out of the Big Book, I say that it's my favorite. So right now at this very present moment, this one is my favorite. And it's on page 18. It says, an illness of this sort, and we have come to believe it an illness, involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him and no one is angry or hurt. But not so with the alcoholic illness, for with it there goes annihilation of all the things worthwhile in life. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents. Anyone can increase the list. We hope this volume will inform and comfort those who are or who may be affected. There are many. And one of the things that I love about that passage in the Big Book is it tells me that this book is not just for the alcoholic. This book is for me. It's to provide comfort and information for me. And I'm so grateful that I've always had every sponsor I've ever had has been a Big Book sponsor. I didn't even know for years and years and years that there was any controversy in Al-Anon about sharing from the Big Book or talking about the Big Book, because it's just kind of how I grew up in the program. So it is great to have a safe space where I can be a member of Al-Anon and share about my experience in the Big Book. So anyway, so I grew up with this alcoholic father whose drinking just got worse and worse and worse. And I only saw him 1 week at Christmas and 2 weeks every summer. And that was kind of the extent of our relationship until my freshman year in high school, when I decided I wanted to go live with him. And it was my first geographic, really. There wasn't really any good reason to go do it other than I felt uncomfortable where I was. And so I thought maybe this would be my chance to go somewhere else. And my dad had actually gotten really sick and ended up in the hospital. And I kind of looked at it as, when I told my mom, it was, I didn't even know him and I wanted to go live with him. And it was the first time that I lived with active alcoholism in my memory. And boy, my Al-Anonism just really blossomed in that environment. All of my defects of character grew very, very well. And it was a really awful time. You know, my stepmom and my dad would start screaming at each other in the middle of the night, and then my dad would disappear for weeks at a time, or sometimes just days at a time. And we never knew when he was coming back, what had happened, why they left. We just continued going on as if life was normal. Until one day my stepmom would take us to the mall and we'd all buy new Gloria Vanderbilt jeans and we'd meet him for dinner and he'd come home and everything was just normal and nobody talked about what had happened. It was just, this time it will be different, you know? There's no reason to think that this time will be different because none of the circumstances had actually changed. There's a saying in Al-Anon, I'm sure it's other places too, if nothing changes, nothing changes. And that's exactly what was happening in the home. At the end of that freshman year, I moved back to Colorado with my mom and my stepdad. And at that point, they had had a little girl and a little boy. And I sent my dad a letter and basically just told him that he was a terrible dad, and that that I was tired of doing all the work in the relationship. And when he was ready to be a good dad, he knew where to find me. And I didn't talk to him for many, many years. He never saw a picture of me in my prom dress. He wasn't there at my high school graduation. what happened at that point is I was really deeply affected by active alcoholism, and I didn't know it. I didn't have any tools to recover from that or to deal with that at all. And so I beat up girls and slept with boys, and that was my solution. Because I could take some of the anger that I was feeling, and if I could corner a girl at her locker and attack her and berate her and humiliate her in front of her friends for a little while, I felt a little bit better. And the same when I was getting attention from boys, you know, when I was, you know, with these teenage boys and they were showing me love and affection in whatever way they could, I felt okay in that little bit of time. It was the summer before my senior year in high school that I met my first him. He was my next door neighbor. He was dating one of my best friends, and he'd already been in rehab 3 times. So I knew that he had some potential. And he was an artist. And what happened was I was looking through his sketchbook, and that he had written a suicide poem. And I remember reading it, and I thought, he wouldn't feel that way if he were with me. And I sought to make him mine, and I did. And we were together for 6 glorious days before we broke up the first time. We almost immediately got back together, and then we broke up and got back together and broke up and got back together. And we did this for years and years and years. And, you know, you guys probably all know the story of what it's like to be in an alcoholic relationship. It did not improve over time. It got a little bit worse over time. He was, we were very violent with each other. I don't want to make it seem like I was an abused girlfriend at all. I was a participant in this. He was taller than me, but he was really skinny. And when he drank lots of whiskey, he'd get off balance. And I kind of felt like I could take him. And so, you know, we'd get into these pushing matches, and eventually we'd get into these hitting matches. And the police officers would show up at our house on a regular basis. We moved every 6 months when the lease was up, because we had to get out of that area. The neighbors weren't looking at us, and the police knew us on a first name basis, and it was just no good. We had to go. And so we would. We'd pack up and move to a new place. And, you know, once again, this time it'll be different. But if nothing changes, nothing changes, and nothing changed. And 6 months after that, we were doing it again. It was all over. What happened for me was that it was the night before my 22nd birthday, and there was a comedy club that was walking distance from our house. And that's always a good thing when you're going to go out, right? Not having to get in the car and drive. And I was the birthday girl. All our friends could get in with us for free. And I would get free drinks and whatever. So it was, you know, it was going to be a fun birthday. And all the friends came over to our apartment and gave me my presents. He gave me a bottle of tequila. Was really thoughtful. And then he drank it, because that's what he did. And we went to the comedy club, and it was great. We had a really fun time with our friends that night. And then we went back home, and all our friends started to leave. And I never liked it when the friends were starting to leave, because it meant a fight. I mean, that's what happened every single time. He was charming, and he was funny. You know, I've always loved alcoholics. All of my boyfriends, you know, had something about them where they drank too much. All of my celebrity crushes have publicly gone into rehab and all of that stuff. I've always loved alcoholics because they're fun and they're charming and they're funny until they're not. And we went out and we came home and everybody left and we started to get into a fight. And this one got a little bit more out of hand than they usually did. And what ended up happening is I stabbed him in the leg with a pair of scissors because it seemed like the right thing to do at the time. And the police came to our apartment as they usually did. And I remember the officer, I still remember what he looked like. His name was Joe, and he showed up. He knew us by name at that point, and he showed up and he said, "Kiri, what's going on here tonight?" And I said, "Oh, Joe, he's hitting me again." And he looks at Dave, and Dave's got, you know, blood coming out of his leg. And he says, "Well, it looks like whatever happened here was at the very least mutual. So I could take you neither to jail, or I could take you both to jail." And I thought that neither to jail was the better option. This was in Texas in 1991, and domestic issues were considered a private matter. This was not something that at the time police tended to get involved in. I will tell you today, do not try to do this. You will both go to, well, you will definitely go to jail. I don't think they'll give you the choice at all, but I said, you know, maybe you can just take him to a friend's house for the night. And he did. And I went to bed that night, cried myself to sleep as I often did. And I woke up the next morning and I felt as alone as I've ever felt in my entire life. And the only way I know to describe it is I've heard that if you put a frog in boiling water, it will try to jump right out. But if you put a frog in tepid water and turn on the heat, it will sit in that pot and slowly boil to death. And that's what had happened to me in living with alcoholism. If it had been like it was at the end, if it had been like that in the beginning, I never would have stayed. But it didn't. It snuck up on me one degree at a time, little by little. It got worse, and I didn't even see that a new line was being drawn in the sand every single day that we were together. And along the way, I was letting go of all of my friends, all of the relationships of people who loved me, people that mattered to me. I let go of my dreams, my ambitions, my hopes, my goals. At one point, I had dropped out of college to work full-time so that we could pay for him to go to school. And I had let go of all of it. And I didn't even see it happening until I woke up and I was that frog. And I was sitting in that pot and I was boiling to death. And I didn't even know who to call because nobody knew what was happening inside my home. And what happened that day was my dad called me. And we hadn't spoken in a long time. It was my actual birthday. It was my 22nd birthday. And he called to wish me a happy birthday. And I didn't know it at the time, but he had been sober in AA at that point for a year and a half. And he was trying to make amends and put his family back together and reach out where he could. And he used my birthday as an opportunity to reach out. And I don't know what inspired me to talk to him. I hadn't talked to him in years. And for whatever reason, maybe it was just desperation or maybe it was God giving me a nudge. I told him everything that was going on in our home. And all he kept saying was, that sounds like alcoholism. That sounds like alcoholism. And I was so happy to have a name for it. I had heard about Alateen. My mom had told me about Alateen when I was a teenager, but I didn't really believe at the time that my dad was an alcoholic or that alcoholism was a problem in my life. I just thought that it was, you know, a bitter divorce kind of thing. And that was what she was saying. And, I found myself in an Al-Anon meeting the very next day. And I got to tell you, I'm so grateful for Al-Anon and I'm so grateful for good sponsorship. And I'm so grateful for meetings that study and practice the traditions because that meeting was the last stop on my bus ride. I was really desperate for a solution. And I had tried a bunch of things. I had tried regular therapy and I had tried group therapy and I had tried Jane Fonda aerobics and I had tried going to church and I had tried a whole bunch of things and nothing was making me feel better. Nothing was giving me a solution. And I went into that meeting and I found my home. I found my home. And today when I'm in a meeting and there's a newcomer there, instead of saying, keep coming back, I usually say, welcome home, because I want people to have that feeling of being home the same way that I have. And I can't tell you what the topic was that night. I don't have any idea. I remember that when they passed the basket, I went to put a dollar in and the woman next to me put her hand on mine and she said, it's okay, honey, this one's on us. And they must have talked about the steps and they must have talked about writing on the steps because I bought some books that night and I went home and I read and I wrote on the steps and I'm sure it was brilliant after one whole meeting. I'm sure it was fantastic. After the meeting, there was a long timer who came up to me and I've always thought that she was like this old lady and she's probably like how old I am now. It was Texas in 1991 and she had like big hair and blue eyeshadow and a thick Texas accent. And she said to me, honey, you are so lucky to have found this program so young. And I just wanted to punch her in the face because I was not feeling like a lottery winner. That is not, didn't come here because Baskin Robbins was out of world-class chocolate, you know? But I do understand now what she meant, and I do absolutely agree with her that I was so fortunate to have found it so young. But I also think that people who find Al-Anon when they're 70 are fortunate to have found it. You know, any time we come in is just the right time. And she said, honey, if you want your life to get different, there are three things for you to do. She said, go to meetings, get a sponsor, work the steps, be of service, and sponsor others. She says, you do those five things and your life will get different. She didn't even promise me that my life would get better, but I didn't care. Different was good enough for me. And then they all invited me to coffee afterwards, which was just the sweetest thing ever, because I was at the point in my relationship where even our crazy alcoholic friends weren't inviting us over. You know, it's pretty bad when your alcoholic friends are like not calling you and telling you about the party. And I didn't go because I was like, I'm not going to sit and talk with people. That's crazy. But I appreciated the gesture, I would say. And so I went home, and I feel like one of the things that I was really lucky for is I hear a lot of newcomers come into Al-Anon and they're looking to get their alcoholic sober. And I wasn't looking for that. I realized before I went to my first meeting that if I looked at all of my relationships, there were only two things that they all had in common, and one was alcohol and one was me. And so I knew that I was part of the problem. And I understood that it was the first drink that got them drunk. I remember, you know, when Dave and I were together, and by the way, so his name was Dave, and I'll get to more on that in a minute. I'm going to try to keep my train of thought. I often take left turns, and you guys are just going to have to hold on and turn with me. I knew that it was the first drink that got him drunk. He would go through these periods of sobriety. There were lots of times, you know, he'd be filled with remorse the next day. We'd have these knockdown, drag out fights. He'd be filled with remorse. He didn't remember anything. I remembered it all. It was not fair. It's unfortunate that alcohol works that way. He got to have the blackout, and I was the one that really wanted it. He would get sober. He would admit that he was an alcoholic, and yeah, I've been in rehab, and it took, and then it didn't take. And he would quit drinking for a while. And then I remember this one time we went to this restaurant, and it was shaped like a boat. And it was right after Foster's Lager had come out, and he ordered one. And I said, what are you doing? You don't drink. And he said, it's just one. I've never tasted it. It's brand new. I just want to taste it. It's just one. It's not going to be a problem. And I knew that it was. I knew that, like, it might be just one that night, but I knew that in another 2 weeks, we'd be right back where we'd been 2 weeks before. And so I'm glad that I had that. I had tried everything to help him get sober and be sober. I at one point created a very helpful drinking chart that might help, because I had heard that that if you have more than two beers at a time, you might be an alcoholic. And I had also heard that if you drank every day, you might be an alcoholic. So I created this very helpful color-coded chart, you know, Sunday through Saturday. And the plan was that he could drink every other day, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, but no more than two drinks a day. But because I'm a very giving and generous soul, I also allowed him to drink both Friday and Saturday, and he could have more than two drinks on Friday and Saturday because it's the weekend, it's starting to relax. But he could only have one drink per hour, because I'd also heard that it takes the body approximately 1 hour to metabolize an alcoholic beverage. So I thought it was a very good plan. And really, when you write it down and look at it, theoretically, it is a very good plan. And somehow he still ended up in a blackout every Friday and Saturday night. I don't know how that happened. Because I had a really good plan. So I feel like I knew that I was powerless over alcohol when I came in here. I had given it everything. I had given it all of my money. I'd given it all of my energy, all of my thoughts, every bit of me. And I was sick from it. So I was ready. That was an easy admission for me. It's everything else in the world that I also am powerless over, that sometimes that I have a hard time remembering. I have a friend who says to me, acceptance is being willing to end your longstanding argument with the universe. and that's, you know, that's always, I might as well end it, right? Because I'm certainly not going to win that argument. So I started going to meetings and he left to go to New Mexico. He was going to get sober and I was going to go to meetings and get Al-Anon. And so he went to New Mexico where his brother was. And I found out later that the way they tried to get sober is every day they'd go and buy a 12 pack of beer, go sit on the water in the boat and fish and drink the beer and talk about how they both probably needed to stop drinking. So it's not quite as effective as AA tends to be. He came back. I didn't know that he had actually spent the whole summer drinking. He told me that he was sober. And I ended up getting a sponsor sort of in Houston. I say sort of because I never took sponsor direction and I didn't use her as a sponsor. You know, I think that there's a big difference between having a sponsor, using a sponsor, and being sponsored. And I aim for being sponsored, which is, you know, when my sponsor asks me to do some writing or to say a prayer, I try to respect that and I try to do that because I found my second sponsor pointed out to me that my way didn't work, that the universe had made that abundantly clear, and that maybe I should just be willing to try another way. And that's what I do with my sponsor today. But that first sponsor, she used to call me Yabba, because anytime she said something to me, I said, yeah, but I think my case is different. Yeah, but that's not going to work for me. And here's why. And so she called me Yabba. So Dave and I decided, my dad offered to have us move to California. And he was going to help me get back into school. And so that's what we did. You know, it was kind of it was probably a little bit of a geographic, but I certainly wasn't in a good spot where we were. And so we went to California. We were living in my dad's house. And, he was dating somebody who was like 6 months sober. My dad was like a year and a half sober. My boyfriend was dry. He was still smoking pot. But I didn't mind that so much because he didn't get violent. He was just kind of like, hey. And then, you know, me with, not any good Al-Anon program. We were all living in the same house. It was certainly a very peaceful and serene place to be. And I didn't know what to do. I was really lonely and I was not in a good place, you know, emotionally or with my relationship. And so all I did was go to meetings. And I'm so grateful because I ended up in all the meetings where people were going to meetings. They were doing the steps. They had sponsors. They were working with others. They were being of service. They were doing all of those things that long time where he told me at my very first meeting. And that's what I did. I was going to three Al-Anon meetings a week. I started sponsoring Alateen and I attended an open AA meeting every week as well. And at some point, a long timer said to me, pointed out that my best thinking had gotten me here and that maybe I wanted to get a sponsor and start really working the steps. And so that's what I did. You know, when I got to step two, I had a real hard time admitting that I was, or that I was the one that was crazy because, I'd been the one holding everything together. Like I was the one that had the job. I was the one that was paying the bills. I was the one that was pushing them out of bed so they'd get in the shower and show up to work. What do you mean I'm the one that's crazy? And it wasn't until looking at the bedevilments in the big book that it became really, really clear. Because when I look at all of those things, being a feeling of uselessness, the only one of those that didn't really apply to me was we couldn't make a living, because I could make a living. I was the one that was making the living. But quite honestly, looking at the living that I was making, it was certainly not what I was capable of. And I definitely was not the best employee on the planet. There were plenty of times that we stayed up too late in the night arguing, and I just couldn't bring myself to get up and go in and face everybody, or my eyes were swollen from crying. And looking at those bedevilments and really having an honest conversation with my sponsor about that helped me realize that perhaps I was not the most sane person on the planet at that moment, even if I had been on one level, I was maybe the most sane person in the relationship. Also, maybe not, totally up for debate. But anyway, so, you know, I was working on the program and I had this sponsor, and every time I started talking to her, you know, I was surrounded by all these people who were couples that had successfully gotten into recovery together, and they, you know, had a white picket fence, and they had Al-Anon birthday parties at their house and baby showers. And, and they were both in recovery, and they'd go to conventions together, and ooh la la, and I wanted that. I thought this is what I want for my life, and I can have this. And I kept asking my sponsor, like, how do you know when it's time to go? And she would say the other very helpful thing that sponsors tend to say, you'll know when you know. I've never found that to be helpful, but I've always found it to be true. And she said, you know, right now, just focus on yourself. Just keep doing your program the best that you can, and try to detach and stay out of his way. I was years in Al-Anon before I heard the three G's, and it was get off his back, get out of his way, get on with your life. And I thought that was a great one for me to remember. And so that's what I was trying to do at the time. And I was hopeful that he would find sobriety, and he didn't. And eventually one day it just got really clear. And I just knew that he needed to drink, and I needed to be with somebody who didn't need to drink. And so we parted ways. And I didn't do it in a hateful way, and I didn't do it in a spiteful way. I just let him go. And I found out that after some time after we broke up, he got sober and was in AA, but he eventually lost his sobriety. And I found out that years later, he lost his sobriety, and he ended up putting a shotgun to his heart and pulled the trigger. And I'm sure that his death certificate says that he died of a gunshot wound to the heart, but we know he died of alcoholism, you know, and there's so many deaths that are attributed to one thing or another that probably really are just, you know, when you strip everything else away, that it's about alcoholism. And I think it's also really important for me to remember that alcoholism kills alcoholics, but alcoholism also kills those of us who are not alcoholics. When I think about all the times that I contemplated suicide, all the times that I gotten in a car with him and let him drive when he was too drunk to drive, or all the times that I was, you know, I used to party right along with him because I tried to, like, well, if I drink the beer, then he can't. And all the times that I was too drunk to drive, but I drove anyway because he was passed out on the couch. Almost 11 years ago, I had a sponsee who was, from the outside, it looked like she was doing the deal. She was a service. She went to meetings. She was in the middle of a four step. And one night she was supposed to chair our Wednesday night meeting. And instead she went to a state park and put a gun to her heart and pulled the trigger, and she died. And she died of alcoholism in recovery, you know? So I just started, you know, after he left, I started really just, I had nobody else to focus on but me. And wasn't that a good thing? Wasn't that a blessing and a real gift from my higher power? You know, I mentioned that I had I've always had big book sponsors. And when I got to step three, my sponsor sat down with me, and she had me read from the big book out loud to her, starting from page 60, but she had me do it in the first person perspective. So it would say, and it was very challenging to do it at first. So the first requirement is that I be convinced that my life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, I am almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though my motives are good. I try to live by self-propulsion. I am like an actor who wants to run the whole show. And it was the first time when she had me do that, it was such a powerful experience, because it was the first time, I think, that I was reading the big book for me and not in the perspective of, oh boy, I hope someday he reads this part. Oh boy, I should read this part to him. Maybe he'll understand if I share this with him. And it explains to me why I relate so much to the alcoholic, as much to the alcoholic a lot of times as I do to the Al-Anons, because we're all suffering from the disease of alcoholism. And I love that after the third step prayer, it says that it will have little lasting effect unless at once followed by this other actions that we take. In Al-Anon, we tell newcomers a lot of times about the three C's. You didn't cause it, you can't control it, and you can't cure it, talking about alcoholism. But I've also been told there's another C that's just for me. I can complicate it. I can create chaos. I can contribute to the problem. And that's what the four step really did for me, is it shows me that side of myself where I'm contributing to the problem, where I'm making things worse. And I wanted to sponsor Alateen. My sponsor was an Alateen sponsor, and I wanted to sponsor Alateen. And she told me that I had to finish my fourth and fifth step before I could start sponsoring Alateen. Now, that wasn't an Al-Anon rule. I don't think it's still an Al-Anon rule. It was her own rule. Maybe it had been passed on to her. It was a smart decision, I'm sure. But so I wasn't scared of my first four step. I really wanted to do it because I was excited. I wanted to sponsor Alateen. I did get a little bit scared when it was time to share the fifth step with her. But you know what happened for me when I did is I heard the two most important words. They were the two most important words she could have said to me then. And it's still the two most important words that I hear every day. And it's me too. You know, everything that I shared with her, she would just nod her head and she would just say, oh, me too. I felt that. I did that. I am that. And it reminded me again that I'm not alone. And then when we were done, she told me how much she loved me. And here I was always afraid to show people who I really am. And I showed her everything and she still loved me. And she reminded me that my higher power also still loved me. And what a comforting situation that was for me. And I try to, whenever I hear a fifth step, I try to give that same love to somebody else. And it's also such an honor to hear somebody's fifth step because I was not a trustworthy person when I was living in the disease of alcoholism. And I would betray anybody at the top of the hat, at the drop of a hat, if I thought it would benefit me. And I'm not that person today. And I'm so grateful that I can be a trustworthy person. Step six is a different one for me because, you know, all of the steps are written with an action, like made a decision, came to believe, we wrote an inventory. And in step six, the phrasing of it, we're entirely ready. It's a state of being. And for me, it's a promise. You know, if I've done the work in steps one through five, I am ready. Doesn't mean I'm willing. Those aren't the same things for me, but I'm ready. I have the tools that I need. I have a sponsor that I trust. I have a God that I trust. And I have the support of the program behind me that I'm ready to now work on the next part. Step seven, you know, I was painfully aware of some of my defects of character before I came into Al-Anon, and I would decide that I was going to be different, and deciding that I was going to be different never made me any different. And in step seven, being able to give that to my higher power was such a freeing and painful experience. I don't like step seven. It's not my favorite. I find it very challenging. You know, when my higher power decides it's time for me to work on patience, well, that's the day that I get stuck in the traffic or stuck in the line, you know, at the grocery store behind the lady paying with pennies and coupons. And it's a challenge for me, but there's a saying that the farmer doesn't grow the corn. The farmer creates an environment in which corn can grow, and then God grows the corn. And that's my job in step seven, is I get to create that environment by showing up, by starting my day with prayer and meditation, by reaching out to my sponsor, by working with the women that I sponsor, by reading the literature, by going to meetings, by trying to practice kindness in my own family. All of these things create the environment which make me maybe a little easier for my higher power to work with. Steps eight and nine. Thank you. Okay, we gotta go really fast because I have a story that I really, really, really want to tell you. So steps eight and nine is where the magic happened. And my first sponsor told me one of the secrets in the big book is that where it says we will, it's a promise. And when it says we ask, it's a prayer. And if I can just look for the we wills, then I know what I'm working for. And if I look for the we asks, I know what to say to my higher power. If I'm ever struggling, then that's where I can go to. And a lot of magic started to happen to me. In step nine. And, you know, reading the step nine promises, what it tells me is that going through this process is going to make me a different person. And that's what it's done. And 10, 11, and 12 have just made me, that's where I try to live every day. You know, each day I try to look at where my selfishness, my fears, my dishonesty, my resentments are preventing me from living my life and from loving others. And that's really what it comes down to when I'm living in selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. That's what happens for me. It separates you, me from you, and it separates me from my higher power. And that's just not where I want to be today. And in 12, I get to have some forgiveness over myself. You know, I do try to practice these principles in all my affairs. And some days I'm really good at it, and some days I'm really bad at it. Some days I'm the message and some days I'm the warning, right? But what I've been told is that I'm not responsible for my first thought. I am responsible for my second thought and my first action. So my first thought oftentimes is one of anger or jealousy or fear or envy, resentment, any of that stuff. But if I can then take that and give those feelings to my higher power and then ask for the next right action, then I have the right place to go. I want to tell you guys a story because it's something that I've been thinking about a lot. lately, and it's, for me, it's really pertinent to what's happening in our world right now. So last year, Colorado experienced this terrible blizzard. It was called a bomb cyclone, which I'd never even heard that term before. And it was really bad. First of all, my in-laws had arrived and they'd forgotten to tell us that they were coming for a visit. So that was fun. And they didn't get to leave when they were going to leave because all the flights were canceled. So they got to be here for extra time. And that was also fun and unexpected, but actually it turned out really good. But we lost power that day, like for several hours. And then also that day, like Twitter and Facebook were down, whatever, they were hacked. Cause I kept going on there trying to find out what was going on with the power situation. And I couldn't get on there. And I thought, this is probably how I die. Like, I think the world's coming to an end and I think we're probably going to die. And my mom and my stepdad, live about an hour away. My stepdad has Parkinson's. I've been really blessed in that I've had two fathers, and I lost my biological dad. I didn't even get to his story or to my story with him. But I lost him to cancer, when he was 18 and a half years sober. He was 57 years old. And I got to love him through that whole process and show up for him in a way that I had never known that I was capable for. So my stepdad has Parkinson's, and I texted my mom that day and asked her how things were going. And she said, they're fine. She said, the storm hasn't hit here yet. But I hope that David comes back soon. He went out for a run. On the days that my stepdad feels good, he likes to go out. They live at the base of Pikes Peak. And there's a race that happens, the Pikes Peak Marathon that happens. And my stepdad ran it for years and years. And he still likes to go hiking up the incline on the days that he feels good. And for whatever reason, he decided that the day a blizzard was coming was a good day to do that. And I said, well, did you try calling him and tell him that the storm's coming? Like, it's going to be there in half an hour. And it happened really fast. Like at 9:30, there was no storm. And at 10 o'clock, I couldn't see the house across the street. And she says, no, he left his phone here. And I said, well, I'm sure once the storm hits, you know, he'll be back pretty quick. And she said, yeah. And a couple of hours went by and my mom texted me and she said, David's still not back. And I thought, and I said, well, where is he? And she says, he's up on the mountain. And I remember thinking, like, this is it. We're losing my stepdad today. And I immediately texted my best friend and my sponsor, and I asked them to pray. And one of the things that I've been told is that there's no reason to worry, because most of the things that I worry about aren't going to come to pass. And even if they do, all I've done is live it twice. And I don't want to live it twice. So I said a prayer. My best friend said a prayer. My sponsor said a prayer. I turned to my husband. I said, he's not back. You know, we just try to think positive thoughts. But I was sure, like, he's up on a mountain in the middle of a blizzard. There's no other alternative here. There's no way that anything can happen other than we're going to be burying my stepdad this week. Well, what happened was my mom called the police. The police came to her house. She's lived in this small town for a long time. They know her. Happened to be somebody that I went to high school with. And she's given the report, and they hear sirens going up to the base of the mountain. And she says, oh gosh, I wonder if that was David. And the officer says, well, let me check. So he gets on the walkie-talkie and he comes back and he says, yeah, they found him. And my mom says, is he alive? And they said, yeah, but barely. He has this Parkinson's medication and it makes his blood pressure really, really low, like super low. Like sometimes it's like 60 over 40. And they got him down off the mountain. What happened is that day, there was a volunteer firefighter. He had been the fire chief at one point and was a retired firefighter and went up onto the mountain also. And I don't know if he was just making another dumb decision like my stepdad was, or if, you know, from his years of experience in the fire department, he thought I should probably go up there, or if he just got a nudge from a higher power that said, you know, go up on the mountain, whatever it is, it doesn't really matter, but he was up there and he came across my stepdad. He'd been blown off the trail and he had water and he had a Mylar blanket and warm up stuff with him, and he helped him down the mountain. And when they got him to the hospital, and this was after they'd been doing warm-up procedures, the doctor said that my stepdad's core body temperature was only 86 degrees. And he said, I've never seen anybody alive with a core body temperature of 86 degrees. But with my stepdad's Parkinson's medication, it took his blood pressure down so low that it made it possible for him to withstand something that there's no reason in the world that he should have withstood. And the reason I've been thinking about that story lately is because I was sure I knew how this story was going to end. I had it figured out. There was only one way that this could possibly turn out, and it was going to be that we were going to be burying my stepfather. But the thing that is so important for me to remember is my higher power can perform miracles. My higher power can solve problems that are beyond my human comprehension. And all I have to do is remember to rely on that. You know, I've heard people say that that God's a gentleman and he won't go where he's not invited. And I understand that sentiment, but I don't agree with it. I don't believe it, because I have seen my higher power working in my life long before I welcomed him. And even today, when I am a self-will run riot, my higher power steps in and shows up in ways that I can't even imagine. And I am so, so terribly grateful. I have 1,000 more stories that I would have loved to have shared tonight. I think that that's what happens. But I'm so grateful to have been a part of this conference. I'm so grateful to be here with all of you tonight. My heart is so full. It's spilling out my eyes. And it has just really been a pleasure. And I love you all. Thanks.
Wow, thank you, Carrie. Love you so much. We will now take a very short break for you to stretch your leg and meet back in 10 minutes for our final meeting of the conference. It is by group conscience of the Fellowship of the Spirit of New York that we do not close each meeting with the Lord's Prayer. Instead, we encourage that this whole conference be treated with an attitude of continuous prayer, and we will then say the Lord's Prayer together at the close of this conference tonight. Please help me close the meeting by joining in a moment of silence. Let us share our spiritual experience and strength with each other so that we can grow together in greater understanding and love.